When you stand up and you wax nostalgic and say things like, I want the country that the founders envisioned, when the country the founders envisioned was a formal system of white supremacy, excuse me if I find it a little hard to think that race is not perhaps playing a pretty big role.
Part two of our presentation and discussion of White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America by Tim Wise. And in an historic event, the descendants of Black Civil War veterans march up Pennsylvania Avenue. All that and more coming up next. Welcome to Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the on-the-ground edition for May 21st, 2015 on WPFW Washington 89.3, your station for jazz and justice in the nation's capital. I'm Esther Rivera. I'm here on our third week of the spring fundraiser for On the Ground. Congrats to Dave Zire and Eitan Thomas for their fundraising on the Collision. Always excellent content, always on the point. On our show, part two of our discussion with Tim Wise about his new powerful documentary, White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America, which we will play a portion of again. This is our thank you gift today as we continue to celebrate being on the air for 1 year as your show based here in the DMV dedicated to activists and activism and bringing you the voices, our voices, that we won't hear on the evening or cable news, activists protesting against war, police brutality, taking a stand for indigenous peoples or for the survival of the internet or our one and only planet. My goal is only $500, so four people pledging for a new or renewing membership of only $10 a month. So I know we should far surpass that again. So you can get me started by calling 202-588-9739, 202-588-9739, or pledging right online at wpfw.org. You press the donate button and make sure you select Thursday's Community Watch and Comment on the ground. It won't say on the ground, but it'll say Thursday's Community Watch and Comment on the drop-down menu. As always, we have a lot for you in this less than an hour, including anti-racism activist Tim Wise and his new documentary, White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America. But first, we'll start with a few headlines. African Americans marched up Pennsylvania Avenue on Saturday, not carrying signs about police brutality, but wearing the uniforms and period dress of the Civil War. They were marking the sesquicentennial of the Grand Review Parade, which signaled the official end of the war between the states 150 years ago this month. The black marchers were also correcting a historic wrong. While President Andrew Johnson forbade the nearly 200,000 black soldiers who had served in the war from marching in 1865, on Saturday, descendants of those soldiers marched to honor them and honor their pivotal role in fighting for their own freedom.
My name is Audrey Hinton. I'm from Washington, D.C.
And who are you marching for today?
My great-grandfather. His name was Frank Garrett Hinton. He served in the 12th Heavy Artillery Unit. He was from Kentucky.
And I understand that at some point the black descendants weren't able to march in the original parade, so this is like a special event for her.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
Such a very special occasion. You're right. Back in 1865, when the war was over and the Union troops came to march through Washington for a victory parade, that parade, by the way, took two full days. The African American soldiers were not invited to participate, and they did not. So today we've kind of corrected that wrong in history by allowing black and white troops to march together. This has really been very moving for me. I got choked up so many times watching this. I like pomp and circumstance, but this was just beautiful.
And tell me about this beautiful outfit you have on. It's kind of a sage green with white ruffle at the bottom.
Yes, it is. Well, actually, I rented it from a costume shop. But I am so into this now. I want to buy a dress that's reminiscent of the Civil War period and maybe become a reenactor at some point.
Yeah. My name is Adrienne Abiodun, and I'm from Sarasota, Florida. I'm marching on behalf of a few people, namely Alexander Branch, who was part of the 4th Color Cavalry in Louisiana. And I'm also marching on behalf of Alexander Jones, both of whom are my 4th great-grandfathers. And Alexander Jones was a private scout for Lieutenant Earl, also in Mississippi. This is my son. His name is O'Neill, and he is 14 months old. And I have my 3-year-old daughter here with me as well. Her name is Naomi.
My name is Letha Granberry. I am from Piperton, Tennessee. It's a little small town about 20, 25 miles east of Memphis. And I'm out here today honoring my great-great-grandfather. He fought in the Civil War. He was a cannon shooter. So since they were not able to march, this is the 150th anniversary that later on this month. So he organized this march for the colored troops since they did not get a chance to march with President Andrew Johnson and the rest of the Union soldiers.
And tell me your ancestor's name.
My ancestor's name is Roden Granberry. He was from Tennessee. He fought, his regiment was the 59th Regiment, Company D.
My name is Jacqueline Smith. I'm from Youngstown, Ohio. And I am marching here with my husband, who is has a descendant. He is a descendant of one of the Civil War soldiers.
What's his name?
Jonas Blannon, yes.
Okay, and how did you design these outfits you have here?
They are authentic Civil War dress, and mine came from Gettysburg, and my sister here made my bonnet for me, and this is actually my wedding dress.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
I had a period wedding, yeah.
My name is Yolanda Burgess, and I'm from Detroit, Michigan. I have two ancestors who fought in the Civil War. I have a great uncle who fought with the 55th USCT Infantry, and he enlisted in Corinth, Mississippi, and he got sick. He caught measles and lost his voice, so he was medically discharged. My great-grandfather, whose name was Armstead Burgess, fought at Fort Pillow, survived, and was a POW. And was MIA-KIA for about a year and a half. And on May 19th, he reports back to duty at Memphis, Tennessee. So I got to have an anniversary that's coming up on May 19th because they thought he had been killed with a lot of his other comrades. I think there was about a 60% casualty rate, and he was one of the survivors. So I'm marching and celebrating with my great, in honor of my great-grandfather, Armstead Burgess, and my great-uncle, Robert Burgess.
Almost 200,000 black soldiers fought for the Union during the Civil War. Today begins a week of actions and civil disobedience by the Coalition Beyond Extreme Energy to oppose new fossil fuels extraction and expansion. The focus of the activities is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission located at 888 First Street Northeast here in D.C., but there are also more actions scheduled for Calvert County, site of a proposed and highly controversial export facility for liquefied natural gas at Cove Point. The week-long action is called Stop the Furcus, and you can get more information at beyondextremeenergy.org. Other actions today include a march and rally at noon at D Street and New Jersey Avenue Southeast to stop Fast Track and the Trans-Pacific Partnership Treaty, or TPP, and that's sponsored by Popular Resistance, a 6:30 program part of the hashtag Say Her Name movement, and the National Day of Action for Black Women and Girls to recognize the ways that black women have been impacted by police and other forms of state violence. That's at 901 G Street Northwest. And at 7 p.m., there will be an emergency vigil on the West Lawn of the Capitol to sunset the Patriot Act. This vigil will be one of several vigils at sunset today calling for the sunset of the Patriot Act, which since 9/11 has curtailed civil liberties and expanded the United States surveillance state. And those are our headlines and happenings. When we come back, White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America. Stay with us.
Open up the door. I'll tell him myself. I don't want nobody giving me nothing. Open up the door. them. Open up the door, I'll get them myself. I don't give me integration, give me true communication.
Well, White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America is based on the work of acclaimed anti-racist educator and author Tim Wise. It explores race and racism in the U.S. through the lens of whiteness and white privilege in a stunning reassessment of the American ideal of meritocracy and claims that we've entered a post-racial society. Wise offers a look back at the race-based white entitlement programs that built the American middle class and argues that our failure as a society to come to terms with this legacy of white privilege continues to perpetuate racial inequality and race-driven political resentments today. For years, Tim Wise's best-selling books and lectures have challenged some of our most basic assumptions about race in America. So White Like Me is the first film to bring the full range of his work to the screen to show how white privilege continues to shape individual attitudes, electoral politics, and government policy in ways too many white people never stop to think about. So before I go to this week's excerpt, I want to remind you to call into 202-588-9739 to get your copy for a new or renewed membership to WPFW. Or, you know, you can pledge for someone else. You can get it for someone else if you've already pledged to support our spring membership drive. Here we go with this week's excerpt of White Like Me.
Where I give talks, whether it's the Deep South, Northeast, Midwest, or the West Coast, white folks ask me, well, what about us? Why don't you talk about racism against white people? The undercurrent in all of this is the sense that efforts to curb discrimination against people of color, while admirable in the past, have gotten out of control and are somehow now hurting whites. And you'll hear this kind of thing all the time. People complaining about what they call reverse discrimination.
This is a case of clear and obvious reverse discrimination.
Complaining about affirmative action.
What do you think that affirmative action is for?
Affirmative action is to increase diversity by discriminating against white males, and that's why I oppose it.
Or they say that since we have scholarships for black students, we should have scholarships for white students only as well.
Dozens, hundreds, thousands of ethnically based scholarships that were for this group, that group, or whichever, mm-hmm. but none of them were focusing on Caucasian Americans.
The implication is that if we're being fair, we should also talk about how white people are sometimes the victims of racism. In fact, when researchers from Tufts and Harvard universities recently asked white people if racism against whites was worse than racism against people of color, most of them said yes, that the gains of people of color were coming at a direct cost to whites.
I'm really not proud of this statement that I'm about to make, but if I look at an application and I see we're an equal opportunity employer, like, that's great, A-plus job. But in the back of my mind, I'm kind of like, crap, I hope they don't have like this kind of quota thing, like you guys were saying, where they need to fill up a certain amount of different races. I feel weird saying anything about this just because it's just like, oh, this is what it's like, so.
And while there's no question, there's real anxiety and fear when it comes to programs like affirmative action. The fact is, for every person of color who benefits from affirmative action in college, there are two white students who received preferential treatment because of their parents' alumni status or other family connections.
If in fact the concern over so-called reverse discrimination had any relationship to reality, people of color would in fact be getting all the good stuff. Some people think they are. I hear it all the time. People of color are taking all the good jobs. Where the hell are these jobs in Second Life?
Another study found that only about 0.25% of all the scholarship money in this country is specifically earmarked for students of color, which means 99.75% of all that scholarship money is money that whites can compete for, and the vast majority of those dollars will in fact go to white students. There's also the fact that the schools attended by mostly black and Latino students are more than 10 times as likely as majority white schools to be places of concentrated poverty.
By the time anyone steps on a college campus, there has already been 12 to 13 years of institutionalized affirmative action for white folks. That is to say, racially embedded inequality, which has benefited those of us who are white.
But even though that's true, there's clearly this feeling among a lot of white people that things used to be easier and that now those good old days are slipping away.
How did we get here? I don't even understand this America anymore.
And underneath all of that is a very clear, if unstated, racial subtext.
Time now to talk about what matters, and we're going to continue our conversation about all the vitriol going on in the country. I spoke with anti-racist activist Tim Wise about the tone of the Tea Parties being held.
In 2009, I was asked to appear several times on CNN to talk about the Tea Party, a group of conservative Americans who had been holding rallies around the country, clamoring for the U.S. to return to a time of low taxes and small government.
Basically, restoring conservative values to the country.
Too much government, but the government is never bigger than the people.
Smaller government, lower taxes, and individual freedom.
The author of Between Barack and a Hard Place, his name is Tim Wise, he told me there are some racist undertones to these rallies.
Well, like I've said on the show before, it is the background noise of a lot of the opposition. Not all of it, but a lot of it.
My point on the show was that while the Tea Party movement purported to be about things like big government, exploding debt and deficits, liberal elites being out of touch with the common man, in reality, there was something else going on.
We are losing our country. We think the Muslims are moving in and taking over.
They're taking our liberties away. It's tyranny. It's a good Gestapo-type tactic.
I want you to check out this protester. See the sign he's waving there? It's the president made to look like an African witch doctor that was a popular prop at Saturday's rally.
Along with anxiety and fear about the economic crisis, there's also been a lot of unease about the fact that we have a black president and that the demographics of the country are shifting in ways that point to a future where whites will no longer be the clear majority. All of this helps explain why some of these folks are so adamant, so angry, so upset that they, and I'm using their words now, want to take their country back.
We want our country back!
We want our country back!
Tea Party message to Washington that we're going to take our country back.
We're just plain American people who are mad. We want to take our country back.
I've got to run here, but just real quickly, I know I was at a town hall yesterday, and I really had to take some people to task. Very nice people, but they were using those buzzwords that I don't think people realize all the time, like real Americans or give me back my America was one of the songs, or take back America. It's like, where has... what do you mean by that?
Well, when you stand up and you wax nostalgic and say things like, I want the country that the founders envisioned, when the country the founders envisioned was a formal system of white supremacy, excuse me if I find it a little hard to think that race is not perhaps playing a pretty big role.
After one of the CNN appearances, I got an email from a woman who was a Tea Party supporter who was upset with my characterization of the Tea Party movement. She said that their calls to take the country back had nothing to do with race, that they were simply calling for a return to an era of low taxes and small government. When I replied to her, I asked her to give me a year that epitomized in her mind this era of American history. Which year did she and the rest of the Tea Party want to return to? Her response was almost immediate and not very surprising. The year she chose? 1957.
Leave it to Beaver.
It's a year that many conservative white Americans hold dear, and not just because it's the year Leave It to Beaver premiered on television.
Traditional America as we knew it is gone. Ward, well, June, Beave, out of here.
For many conservatives, that was the golden age of American history, a time when everything was in its place before all the struggles for equality and justice came along in the 60s and messed everything up.
Do you remember how that felt? Do you remember what life was like?
There's this sense that we've lost something precious, special, deeply American.
This is about the systematic dismantling of this country.
We are truly concerned about the heartbeat of our country.
They can have my country when they pry it from my cold, dead fingers.
That people are overtaxed, overburdened, forced to hand over their hard-earned money to government bureaucrats so they can reward people for not working.
I think the fact is Americans are overtaxed.
Government is spending too much, that we pay too high of taxes.
I mean, everyone in America knows that Americans are overtaxed. Hello, we pay more taxes than we used to pay at every level.
The only problem with that argument, it's not even close to being true. The fact is, the top marginal tax rate in 2012 was 35%. A lot of people today think that rate is too high. But what was the rate in 1957? It was a whopping 91%, nearly three times higher than what it is today.
There's too much involvement in the government. We can take care of ourselves.
Our government is spending far too much, and our federal government is far too large, trying to do far too much.
As for the size of government, in the pre-civil rights golden age, it wasn't small by any stretch of the imagination. The programs created by the New Deal, which disproportionately and almost exclusively benefited white people, weren't just massive in scale, they were massively popular. So why do we have this idea that the pre-1960s was this bastion of American independence and freedom, of small government and low taxes? And why do so many people today want to go back to that mythologized past? According to Martin Gillens, it has everything to do with our perception of who we think is benefiting from government programs today, especially those programs we like to call welfare.
I'm Marty Gillens. I'm a political science professor at Princeton University, and much of my research is on public attitudes towards anti-poverty policy and racial policy. The major work that I've done in that area is a book called Why Americans Hate Welfare.
Welfare spending now topping $1 trillion a year.
The American public tends to view welfare recipients as undeserving, not really working hard to support themselves, and they view welfare recipients as disproportionately black. Both of those perceptions are at variance with what we know about the reality of welfare recipients.
Even though the clear majority of people who benefit from government assistance are white, there's this perception that welfare and other government programs are somehow a black phenomenon. Why is this? Well, Gillen says it's because that's who we see on TV.
Starting in 1965, media portrayals of the poor have been disproportionately African American.
Esther Williams, 21 years old, mother of a 19-month-old infant and a welfare client.
If you look at either print news or television news coverage of poverty, you see far too many black faces relative to the true proportions of African Americans among the poor in this country.
Alcinette Vargas, who has six children and a husband with a minimum wage job, reached her time limit in January without full-time work and was cut from welfare.
So when we see stories about the poor are represented by people of color at a rate that is far greater than statistical reality. But it wasn't always that way. Before the mid-60s, media coverage of the poor consisted mostly of whites. It was the unemployed during the Depression, the people who fled the Dust Bowl, the rural poor in places like Appalachia. And the coverage of these poor white folks was overwhelmingly sympathetic and humanizing. As a result, public support for social safety net programs was high from the period of the Great Depression all the way into the 1960s. But all of that changed.
There are too many people taking advantage of the system. Why don't we spend some time developing a system that weeds out the cheaters?
Once news coverage, media imagery, and political rhetoric started to equate poverty with people of color, we began to view the poor not as fellow Americans who were the hard luck victims of a system that had failed them, but instead as moochers who were abusing the system and undermining the nation's work ethic. And the sad irony is that there are millions of white people in this country who need those programs too. And now they're not there. Those programs have been cut to the bone because the beneficiaries have been seen as undesirable, undeserving others.
How long do we have to pay for slavery? Man, I'm talking about the people on welfare trying to suck out the economy of this country, get a free house, a free car, free gasoline. They want it all because they think they deserve it. Well, in this country, you got to get a job. So don't, you know, and work.
Did you get a tax cut this year from Barack Obama?
I don't pay taxes. I'm disabled from a truck accident and veterans benefits.
May I speak now?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, I'm 90 years old, and I just wanted to ask the colored man, why don't colored people, instead of saying what we did to them, why don't they say what we did for them? They talk about the slavery, but since then they have given welfare, free medicine, free everything.
Ma'am, I think this is more of a conversation about the relationship between the administration and the people on Wall Street, and not necessarily one that's based on race.
Okay, I'm not a racist. That was my comment. Thank you.
None of this is by accident. The racial subtext that runs through a lot of the anti-government rhetoric is the result of an explicit political strategy that's been put to use by conservative politicians for decades.
Here's how I would approach that issue as a statistician or a political scientist, or no, as a psychologist, which I'm not, is how abstract you handle the race thing.
In a recently uncovered recording, the late Republican strategist Lee Atwater, one of the pioneers of race-based political appeals, was heard talking quite openly about how the strategy works.
You start out in 1954 by saying nigger, nigger, nigger. By 1968, you can't say nigger. That hurts your backfire. So you say stuff like horse busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you're getting so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites.
The idea was for Republican politicians to speak in a kind of racial code designed to turn white working class voters against government programs, the very programs that they themselves had benefited from for years.
The present welfare system has become a monstrous, consuming outrage.
Government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
And this kind of thing runs right up to the present day.
President Obama is the most effective food stamp president in American history.
This is precisely the point historian John Bracey, a veteran of the civil rights movement, has been trying to make for years.
What the ruling class in this country has successfully done is to label social programs as black programs, minority programs, and then you can kill it.
I don't want to make people's lives better by giving them somebody else's money. I want to give them the opportunity to go out and earn the money.
You know, that's the most foundational thing in American life. I mean, that's Obamacare.
Everything that is getting pushed through Congress, including this health care bill, are transforming America. And they are all driven by President Obama's thinking on one idea, reparations.
Virtually every normal kind of social program that would have kicked in Europe in the 19th century, you know, in order to help working people, you know, survive under capitalism, we don't have.
While the state's budget deficit has reached almost $500 million now, the state's Medicaid program has announced more than $14 million is being cut to various providers throughout the state.
There are people that won't expand Medicare. Like, I just got back from Mississippi. They're debating expanding Medicare in Mississippi. They need every nickel and dime they can get in there from anybody. They should not question anybody. If Martians came and said, we're going to give you something, they should say, whatever it is, we'll take it, because they need everything. They refuse. They have a political system that's still dysfunctional enough that they turn down aid for white people in Mississippi because black people get some too.
This is how racism victimizes white people indirectly as well. American history is full of examples of white anxiety and resentment around race being used to undermine their own interest and their own well-being.
You've been listening to an excerpt from the new movie White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America by the anti-racism activist and educator Tim Wise on 89.3, your station for jazz and justice. We're in our spring membership drive, and we have this powerful movie for you for a donation of only $75 or at least $10 a month as a new or renewing sustainer, a new or renewing member. And the sustainer program is really great because you may not have $75 right now. You may not have $120, but you can ask us to debit your account for $10 a month, and that way you can provide a steady stream of income to the station. We really, really need it. We're all volunteers except for a very small paid staff. We have to pay our rent. We have to pay for the transmitter. 50,000 watts going out over the DMV to Washington, Virginia, Maryland, Delaware, parts of West Virginia. And we rely on our spring membership drive as well as our four other drives during the year to raise the vital funds that we need. We are totally listener sponsored. We are listener powered. We don't rely on advertising from the oil and gas industry, from the male enhancement industry, whatever kinds of ads that you see on television, and especially this show. You've been on the air for about a year, and we're devoted to activists and activism, and so we're talking about issues that you don't really get to hear on your average evening news, cable news, and so we are looking to you, our listeners in D.C., Virginia, Maryland, and all the communities within Silver Spring. And I think, actually, speaking of Silver Spring, I want to thank someone who's already called in. I want to thank Arthur from Silver Spring, and he's actually going to pick up the African American Historical News Journal, the hardcover book. And that's something we have available in addition to White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America. And we have other gifts. If you call 202 202-588-9739. That's 202-588-9739. Or if you go online to wpfw.org, the website can tell you what gifts are available. But if you call, the operators can also tell you what gifts we have available. And so Tim Wise will actually be joining us in a few minutes, but I want to take a couple of minutes to encourage you to call 202-588-9739 to get a copy of this important new film. It's excellent for your own library to show to your family, friends, young people, and what a way to launch a discussion, a conversation, as we go through this critical Black Lives Matter movement in 2015 about the history, the long history, the recent history about race relations in this country. We're trying to encourage sustainers, so for at least $10 a month, you can become a new or renewing member. If you've already made your pledge, you know, get the DVD for someone else. Get it as a graduation gift. Get it as a Father's Day gift, you know. Get it for someone who, or get more than one for the people who would really use this information. So we're going to take a break right now with Navasha Dea. We actually neglected to give her recognition 2 weeks ago when we played her new tune, but here she is again, the DMV's fierce diva, Navasha Dea, with a new song, and we'll be right back with Tim Wise.
The name of this tune is Baltimore Goddamn, and I mean every word of it. New York got me so upset. Ferguson makes me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Baltimore, goddamn. Florida got me so upset. Chicago makes me lose my rest, and everybody knows about Baltimore, goddamn. Can't you see it? Can't you feel it? It's all in the air. I can't stand the violence much longer. Somebody say a prayer. New York got me so upset. Ferguson makes me lose my rest. And everybody knows about Baltimore, goddamn. This is not a show tune. This is real life. It's all over the news. You may have seen it too. Baltimore is more than the wire, but the lack of equality makes me wanna holler. Mothers losing their children to violence. Fear from snitching has everyone silent. Lord, have mercy on this land of mine. I pray the healing will happen in due time. It's not safe here, it may be safe there. Fear blinds you, somebody say a prayer. Don't tell me, I'll tell you. Reparations and atonement are overdue. I live in this reality, so I know. They keep on saying, go slow. Waiting for progress.
Too slow.
You'll get yours in time.
Too slow.
Why are you so angry?
Too slow.
We have a black president.
Too slow.
The end of racism.
Too slow.
You think I'm crazy?
Too slow.
Where am I going? What am I doing? I don't know. I don't know. Just try to do your very best. Stand up and be counted with all the rest. For everybody knows about Baltimore, goddamn. I mean, do we have to bring up the past? I mean, haven't you people healed from slavery and lynching? I mean, that was such a long time ago. Me, I'm a descendant of those who built this country for free. Oh, we don't want to acknowledge that so many promises made, but look at where we're at. Yes, you lied to me all these years, told me give my education and we will be peers, and speak the Queen's English like a fair lady, and you'd stop calling me Sister Pickaninny Sadie. This whole country. country is full of lies. They will be revealed in due time. I don't trust that you'll help anymore. You keep on saying go slow, but that's just the trouble.
Too slow.
By beggars and a mule.
Too slow.
Their education.
Too slow.
Women's rights.
Too slow.
Stop building those prisons.
Too slow.
The end of violence.
Too slow.
Why don't you feel it? Why don't you see it? I don't know. We can live next to each other, you see. And I claim my equality. Everybody knows about Ferguson. Everybody knows about New York. Everybody knows about Baltimore. God damn.
That was the DMV's own Navasha Deya with Baltimore Goddamn. If you're just tuning in, before Navasha, we were listening to an excerpt from the new movie White Like Me, Race, Racism, and White Privilege in America by the anti-racist activist and educator Tim Wise, which we have available today as a thank you gift. You can call 202-588-9739. To get a copy of the DVD. Now, joining me on the line for part two of our discussion that we started last week is Tim Wise, the world-renowned anti-racist activist and educator, author of several books and DVDs like the new one that we are offering today. Welcome back to On the Ground, Tim.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
Yeah. So when we left off last week, we were discussing the impact of propaganda and misinformation, particularly about how I guess media has led, you know, so many white people to think of government assistance as primarily benefiting blacks and other people of color. So I was wondering, you know, given the clip that we just paid to play today, which was really about the Tea Party and kind of the segment about, like, what about me and ideas about so-called reverse discrimination, if you have any thoughts on the role that media plays in this, particularly Fox News, and creating this echo chamber of racism.
Well, you know, it goes back quite a bit even before Fox. I mean, one of the guys that's interviewed in the documentary, Martin Gillens, who's a professor at Princeton, he wrote a book several years ago called Why Americans Hate Welfare. And what he talked about in that book was how the very notion of assistance for poor people, those in need, or what we now call euphemistically welfare, was really something that the coverage of that, the media representation of those issues, is what changed the public perception of that subject. So, for instance, if you go back, and I think people can sort of intuitively know this if they haven't studied it, if you go back to the 30s, the 40s, during the, you know, aftermath of the Depression, during the Dust Bowl droughts in the Midwest, when there were soup lines around the block in the 30s, for instance, most of the images in media of the people who were struggling, who were poor, who were hungry, were images of white folks, down and out drifters, hobos, you know, riding the trains, right? You know, Woody Guthrie wrote songs about these folks, and they were considered sort of heroes. Steinbeck wrote novels about them. They were considered sort of heroic characters. But what Gillens talked about in his book is how, beginning in the 60s and really concrete by the early 70s, the images of poor folks, the images of people who were in need of government help, switched from being mostly white and having garnered a lot of sympathy when they were portrayed as white, to being black or maybe Puerto Rican, but people of color for sure, in urban areas. And all of a sudden, the very same white Americans, sort of, you know, middle class white folks whose middle class status was in part created by government. It was created by the New Deal. It was created by FHA loans, GI Bill, VA loans. All of a sudden, those very same folks who had no problem with big government, no problem with government efforts to help those in need, suddenly decided, oh, wait a minute, this is bad for you. You know, you can't have welfare. You can't have big government programs. That's going to make people lazy. Well, apparently it didn't do that for white folks. But they all of a sudden decided, oh, if it's going to those people, then it's a bad thing. And the media, as Gillens points out, played a huge role in that. Now, I'm sure that many of the media folks who did that would say that they were trying to show images of folks who were struggling so as to garner sympathy. And I'm sure they might really believe that. The problem is that because of the way this country's been racialized, showing down and out black folks all of a sudden and immediately triggers notions of moral judgment, whereas showing down and out white folks, whether it's in the 30s or remember the 80s, during the farm crisis when you had these white farmers that were losing their farms to corporate takeover. And even though you had a lot of black folks, I mean, Reverend Jackson, 84 and 88, went into the farm belt to try to talk about the interconnectedness of race and class. A lot of people ignored that, of course, but there was a lot of sympathy. We had Farm Aid. We had all the, and all of a sudden, if you're white and struggling, we see the systemic stuff. And if you're black and brown and struggling, we all of a sudden say, I want my country back. I want small government and low taxes. And that's all very much a myth, but it was a myth created, you know, by the media.
Yeah. I want to, follow up, but before I do, I want to remind listeners to call in. I don't hear the phones ringing, and I definitely want to make my goal. We are celebrating our anniversary, 1 year of being on the air, bringing to the air issues of activists and activism, like we're talking about today. We have been out in the street. That's just like you just heard the descendants of Civil War soldiers talk marching up Pennsylvania Avenue, because their descendants, their ancestors weren't allowed to march in the parade in 1865. Black soldiers weren't allowed to march, even though 200,000 of them served in the war. They weren't allowed to march, but their descendants were able to march up Pennsylvania Avenue for the first time during this sesquicentennial of the Civil War ending. And that is the kind of thing that we brought to you for the past year. And I know you appreciate that. So let me hear the phones ringing by calling 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 or pledge online so I can see some results pop up here on the screen. 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739 or WPFW.org. So Tim, aside from the whole welfare issue, how have you seen the issue of affirmative action handled in the same way or differently by the media?
Well, you know, the media, and I think a lot of folks in general in this country, have long had a misunderstanding of that subject. So the way the media has framed it and the way politicians have framed affirmative action has really been problematic in a couple of ways. Number one is that they're constantly using this terminology that's very loaded, you know, the terminology of preferential treatment. Even the pollsters, when they go out and they ask white folks about affirmative action and their views on it, they tend to frame it that way. They say, do you support giving preferential treatment to, you know, black folks, for instance, when it comes to college admissions? Well, you know, if you frame the question that way, if you frame the subject that way, when you hear the term preferential treatment and it's totally out of context, it has no historical context at all, it's just sort of being asked as a question, probably most fair-minded people think, well, no, I don't like that, you know, because they're not thinking about the historical reasons why affirmative action was created. So when you frame it that way, even if you do it somewhat innocently, and I'm sure there are some who think, well, you know, it's a perfectly neutral term, but it's not. The emotional impact of it is not. The reality is, if we're going to use that term, let's at least use it in a historically accurate way. You know, one of the ways that I talk about this in the film and around the country is, yeah, you want to talk about affirmative action as some form of preference, that's fine. But then let's at least talk about the fact that prior to the initiation of this thing we call affirmative action, there were several hundred years, going back to the colonies, of preferential treatment for whites and particularly white men. Going back, the very first affirmative action program, if you want to call it that, was in the colonies. It was called the headright system, and it basically was a program that would give up to 50 acres of free land to European males who were willing to make the trip from England and stake out a claim in the United States. Fast forward to the Homestead Act of 1862, 245 million acres of essentially free land given out to white families. The FHA loans that I referenced a second ago, 97, 98% of those to white families because people of color were essentially excluded from them for the first 28 years or so. So we could go down the line and, you know, on the one hand, I think the term preferential treatment is loaded, but on the other, if we're going to use it, at least let's use it in its proper historical context. If we're going to act as though the notion of racial preference was only created in the late 1960s, early 70s with affirmative action, we're missing an awful lot of American history. That's what Ira Katznelson talks about in his brilliant book, When Affirmative Action Was White. It's what Phil Rubio talks about in his book, A History of Affirmative Action, 1619 to 2000. And it's what I'm trying to talk about in the film. We have to understand the historical precedent for the things that we see today. Otherwise, white Americans come to believe that there's this strange, special thing that we're doing for those people. I mean, the best example of that, there's a brief clip, I think, that's in the film. It's not the full clip, but there's a brief clip of a debate that I had with a young man who, at the time was I think he was the head of college Republicans at UC Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
And we were on CNN debating this, and you know, they were doing one of their bake sales that conservative students do all around the country on campuses, where they set up a table and they sell cookies and brownies, and they sell those cookies and other baked goods cheap to black folks or even free, and then they charge white men like $2. And they're trying to make this pithy kind of snarky point, right, that they're holding black people to a lower standard, and oh, isn't that terrible, and that's just what affirmative action does. You know, they've been doing this for 15 or 20 years. And I was making the point to this young man, who seemed like a relatively nice guy, albeit I think misled, that it was awfully disingenuous of him and his fellow college conservatives to believe that somehow the problem of racial preference only was initiated at the point of applying for and being admitted to the University of California. I mean, first of all, the UC system got rid of affirmative action when this kid was like three. So he hasn't even kept up, just like with basic chronology. There is no more affirmative action as such in the state of California, hasn't been since the mid-1990s. But more importantly, as I pointed out, affirmative action for white students, particularly middle class and above, racial and class preference for mostly whites, has been built into the K-12 education system. So before we even get to the point of applying for college, where we are being told, usually inaccurately, that black and brown folks have such a leg up and such an edge in admissions, we've had 12 to 13 years of preference whereby white students were one-tenth as likely to be attending high-concentrated poverty schools. White students were twice as likely to be taught by the most experienced teachers. They were half as likely to be taught by the least experienced. They were twice as likely to have honors and AP classes, half as likely to be put in remedial classes. I mean, every single educational indicator says that affirmative action for whites had been going on since those kids were five, but now this kid, freshman in college, whatever he was, is all of a sudden awakening to the problem of so-called racial preference, as if somehow getting rid of affirmative action in college would make things equal. Of course, it wouldn't. It would leave that 12 to 13 year head start in place, as it always had been.
Exactly. I am talking to Tim Wise, author, educator, and an activist, and I am still waiting for the phones to ring. 202-588-9739 or 1-800-222-9739, or you can pledge right online at wpfw.org. We can only keep WPFW alive with your help. It's so important that we have a listener's sponsored, community-powered radio station here, right here, within earshot of the halls of power. It's vitally important that WPFW remain here as a place for alternative voices, alternative news, alternative information, alternative music. And we know you support that. We know you're listening. So DC, Maryland, Virginia, Silver Spring, Tacoma Park, College Park, Bowie, Suitland, Arlington, Alexandria, Bethesda, right here in D.C., Northwest, Southwest, Southeast. We need you to call right now, 202-588-9739. Let us know that you appreciate the, and we know you do, but show us that you appreciate the news and information that we bring here during the week on WPFW by calling 202-588-9739. We provide so much of the soundtrack for your day, and we want you to acknowledge and, you know, let us know that you're listening. No, let us know that you're supporting. 202-588-9739. So I also wanted to talk a little bit about the Tea Party. You have a extensive section in the film talking about the Tea Party. And when I've discussed the Tea Party with people, they've given me almost like two different versions of what they think about the party. One version says, well, initially these people were rightfully so, concerned about taxes. You know, it was a real kind of grassroots movement, but it was kind of taken over by ALEC, by the Koch brothers, Americans for Prosperity, and that it turned the movement into something that was more racist, that was more about attacking Obama as opposed to its original principles. What do you think about that, or have you looked into it to that extent?
I mean, first of all, let's be very clear. The self-proclaimed, and I think recognized now, godfather of the Tea Party movement is a business reporter at CNBC named Rick Santelli. And back in, I guess it was in 2009, when he went on the air, many of the listeners will remember this, he went on air and he went on this extended rant.
Oh, yeah.
About the losers, his word, the losers who had gotten in over their heads with mortgages, you know, subprime mortgages, which obviously we know now they were roped into, exploding adjustable rate mortgages, et cetera. And he was calling them losers. He was mocking them, asking for government bailouts. Of course, he had no problem with bailing out the banks. He had no problem bailing out corporations, had no problem bailing out the wealthy. But the idea that we might bail out working class folks or even quote unquote middle class or lower income folks who were now underwater on their mortgages in spite of trying to do everything right, that struck him as, you know, unacceptable. And so he's the one who called for a new Tea Party, and he did it on the floor of the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which is particularly ironic, because here you got a bunch of white dudes behind him who basically make money gambling. I mean, these guys are essentially no different than people playing Texas Hold'em in a Vegas casino. The difference is the stakes are the global economy, and they are manipulating the price of commodities. They are manipulating, as folks are on Wall Street, the price of derivatives and all of these junk economic instruments that brought the economy down. And Santelli basically was blaming it all on working class folks. So to say that the Tea Party really began with an honest, decent, philosophical belief about taxes sort of flies in the face of who actually was the initiator. It was initiated with a political attack upon working class people. He didn't necessarily specify black, but I think that we know if you look at the early rallies, right, the people were showing up with signs that said, you know, your mortgage is not my problem. And they would stand side by side with people that had signs that said, you know, Obama's plan, white slavery, or signs that said, you know, had pictures of the president dressed like a witch doctor with a bone through his nose. I mean, those were in the early days of the Tea Party. If anything, to be perfectly honest, ALEC's involvement, as pernicious as they are, probably professionalized it a little bit and tamped down some of that, because the ALEC folks, I think, had an interest in, and some of these sort of AstroTurf folks had a real interest in trying to make it seem not so sort of lunatic. Now, what's happened in the last few years, as the Tea Party, you know, was able to get some people elected back in 2010 and again in 2014, they've sort of, now what you see, interestingly, is it's sort of gone back to the lunatic fringe in a way. Like, it's now the folks who were still showing up with the tri-corner hats and the Revolutionary War costumes, these are the Alex Jones people. I mean, these are the folks who believe that the president is trying to foment race war and that the, you know, the Jade Helm exercises or some military takeover of Texas. You know, that's really now what you increasingly see in the so-called Tea Party. So I would say it started off with a sort of hardcore race and class contempt for right. people of color and working class people of all color. It went through a phase where it tried to become more legit and talk about taxes and you know, constitutional governance and all of that. And then now it has really reverted back to form. And I think most of those who are just concerned about taxes really are probably going in a different or trying to go in a different direction. But like I say in the film too, I mean, let's be clear. The idea that these folks were worried about taxes, I mean, I point out in the movie that there was a woman who attacked me via email after I had made the point that the Tea Party was operating on the basis, at least in part, of racism by saying, oh, it's not about that. She said it's about taxes and the size of government. And then we went through this sort of back and forth where it finally came out that I asked her, I said, well, when you say you want your country back, what year do you want to go back to? What are you talking right. about? You know, and she said 1957. I mean, right. she didn't even take like an hour to think about it. Like she hit me back immediately. She's like, I don't know, 1957. And that's fascinating because, as I note in the film, the top tax rate in 1957 was 91%. And there were like 17 different tax brackets above anything we have now. Right. So taxes on affluent folks and actually middle to upper middle income folks were higher, 2 to 3 times higher.
I am so fascinated by our discussion, and unfortunately, I've run out of time. But I do want to thank Tim Wise for being my guest today, and also urge you to call, to keep calling. We haven't made our goal at this point, and I'm really disappointed. So I don't want to be disappointed. You can call up into the top of the hour, and even afterward, if you want to pledge for Thursday's Community Watch and Comment, the On the Ground edition. I also want to thank Mike Nasella and my engineer, and thank you for that call. I heard a call, and you can keep on calling. You can reach the show at onthegroundshow.org, where you can now listen to all our shows and past shows. Please like our Facebook and Twitter page at On the Ground Show. Now stay tuned for the news, followed by Chris DeProperty on the Thursday edition of Don't Forget the Blues. Raise your voice. Keep calling now. Peace.